Good afternoon. It's Friday the 13th of September 2019, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. Your host today, Mike Robinson, myself, Brian Gerrish. We're delighted to be joined by David Scott, bringing us northern exposure from north of the border, and David Ellis from Strategic Defence Initiatives.
Who's it unlucky for, Brian?
Well, not the UK column, I don't feel, Mike.
No, but maybe it's unlucky for Boris, I don't know. Or maybe it's unlucky for Juncker, because Boris is heading off to Brussels. No, actually he's not, he's going to Luxembourg. They decided that Brussels was too contentious a place, so they wanted some neutral ground. So they're off to Luxembourg, yeah. So they're off to Luxembourg, which of course is where Jean-Claude Juncker was Prime Minister for 10 years or something like that. So he's waiting for to have a working lunch on Monday over Brexit, of course. These are the first face-to-face talks that he's had in Luxembourg. This is all very exciting stuff. So we'll see what comes out of it. In the meantime, however, I just wanted to mention this, Brian, as an introduction to what you're about to cover. But The Telegraph this morning published this article, Tony Blair and Peter Mandelson pulling the strings of the Remain alliance. Now, this might not be coming as too much of a surprise to very many people, but it's interesting that it's published nonetheless. They're saying Tony Blair and Peter Mandelson are pulling the strings behind the Remainer alliance by giving proxy advice to Labour and Lib Dem MPs. It has been claimed. The former Prime Minister and his new Labour sidekick, once dubbed the Prince of Darkness, are understood to be at the centre of cross-party attempts to block Brexit, including last week's passing of a bill to prevent no deal. A source told The Telegraph, Blair and Mandelson are pulling the strings. Mandelson is the puppet master. He's had meetings via proxy with all parties involved in the Remain alliance and sends emails with ideas. Blair's people have been speaking to Joe Swinson's people. As I say, perhaps not really much of a surprise that this would be going on. Blair has been dying to get back into mainstream politics in recent months and to have a real say in what goes on with respect to Brexit. But since the British public aren't having any of it, it looks like he's trying to do the job from behind the scenes instead.
Yeah, do it in the dark, in the shadows, which is not surprising. But it's getting interesting, Mike, who is starting to speak out and expose a bit of light in the shadows. And I want to bring in this gentleman, Gwythion Prince. Now, you are well aware of David Ellis. You're well aware of this gentleman. He's been working closely with Veterans for Britain. And he has been warning about what's been happening with EU Defence Union. But we're going to say a big thank you to a viewer who realised he'd been talking at an organisation called the Heritage Foundation, strongly US-UK organisation. This is back in May, when Theresa May was still in power. And let me take you through a few bits and then we'll open up some discussion on what he had to say. So this is the first one here. And he started his address to the audience by talking about problems with the Chinese firm Huawei and their desire to come in on Britain's 5G network. And he's talking about security risks. And he starts to ask this question. So why would serving British officials take the continental, i.e. the European continental view, rather than the Anglo view on security risks from the Chinese company, especially when the British people had voted for the open seas over an entangling continental Europe? So he spoke in quite highfalutin language, to put it in that way. But what he was clearly saying was, why is it that we're suddenly seeing British officials taking a very, very pro-European view to the extent that they're prepared to dismiss the wider Anglo-American view? And he went on, the overwhelming number of officials in Westminster and Whitehall and of both Houses of Parliament have not for one second accepted the result of the largest democratic mandate in British history. So this is another warning here that whilst the public might think that they voted and the government would carry out their plans, there's an overwhelming number of officials who don't care a jot and they're going to carry on with the European project. Then he got onto this, which links us straight back into what you've been talking about with Tony Blair might. Instead, assisted by a campaign in the country led by Lords Mallett Brown and Mandelson, along with former Prime Minister Tony Blair, and well funded by Mr. George Soros, they have striven to subvert it by engaging in an entirely unnecessary and mind-bogglingly complicated negotiation about a deal that would deliver a Hotel California Brexit in name only. And we'll just carry on through. So Richard Dearlove and I, together with others, including my military colleagues and veterans from Britain, certainly see the surrenders of UK sovereign control over the prime function of a state, which is the defence of the realm in this way. They're worried about it. He's concerned about it. So, and the previous bit was talking about abandoning natural allies and adherence to the European project. But he's back on the subject to defence. And then he's saying Mrs. May relies on a tiny cell of advisers over constitutional bodies such as the Cabinet Office. And these are the people he's talking about. Gavin Barwell, a Downing Street chief of staff for May. Your friend Mark Sedwell, Mike, who you pointed out was in control of everything, including the security services and their budget, alongside control of the Cabinet Office. So Oliver Robbins, the Prime Minister, the then Prime Minister's Europe advisor, Stephen Parkinson, special advisor. And then we've got this cluster of defence people. So we've got Alastair Brockbank, Angus Lapsley, and Dr. Brian Wells, Director of Science and Technology at the MOD. But we shouldn't forget Philip Hammond, he named, and Sir Alan Duncan, and Mr. May, which I found very interesting. Now, of course, May's gone, but has the power base for this group gone? I don't think it has.
Well, many of those people aren't there anymore. I mean, Gavin Barwell's been replaced by, he's been replaced, but Mark Sedwell is the key character
figure there.
Here.
Yeah.
Yes.
And we've had this astonishing statement by Gwythian Prince that Tony Blair and Mandelson, Mallett Brown, funded by George Soros. Now, the BBC said a couple of days ago that anybody that criticised George Soros was a right-wing extremist. So, Dave Ellis, is Gwythian Prince a right-wing extremist who doesn't understand what's going on in government at the moment?
I'm going to come at this from this perspective. He's certainly got a good understanding of all of that to comment and put it all together with effectively the names and places. But I would firstly say, you know, all credit to the guy. He's out there saying it and doing it. So, you know, he needs to be praised for that. And I would only add this one thing, that from the papers that we've seen across the sort of UK column network that go back to the Attlee period, so that's 4th of January 1948, from the top secret papers from on, clearly articulating those Cabinet Office papers. So we then see the connection between Cabinet Office and all of these Wallers currently, that they're effectively reading from the same script, i.e. that they always sought this defence union with the Germans, in effect, or the most of the sort of, you know, what would be the meat or the muscle there in Europe. So, i.e. the Germans. So that was always there. So that, so, you know, what can we say about Sedwell? He's still reading from the original script that's probably developed over the decades. But nonetheless, that script hasn't changed. So we've got an alternate perspective here being offered from Gwillian to say, well, really, the traditional sort of way here has been with America. So we can see that this axis that Alex Thompson refers to between from Germany and the Jerusalem axis and then the New York axis. So we can see where the power struggle is actually sort of panning out. But I've got to say this, where Gwilliam is concerned, clearly, you know, people's votes in this country count for nothing.
Right. Well, look, David, I wanted to cover one of the things that we mentioned on Wednesday in a little bit more depth today, because now, what is Europe doing in building defence union? What exactly are we talking about? And who are going to be the main players as we move forward through the next 5 years? Now, obviously, Boris is going to meet Jean-Claude Juncker on Monday. But Juncker's within his last few weeks of being president of the European Commission, and the new president, of course, is Ursula von der Leyen. You're talking about the Germans there. She's the former German defense minister. We mentioned this on Wednesday, but I want to go into a little bit more depth, as I say. She wrote letters to all the new EU commissioners on Wednesday. And here is one of them. This is the mission letter to Josep Borrell. Now, Josep Borrell is the former Spanish foreign minister. He's been moved over to become the high representative for the Union for Foreign Policy and Security Policy. He replaces Federica Mogherini. In this letter, she says, you know, really, we're wanting to build with our new commissioners, and we're wanting to build one team. The European Commission, she says, functions on the principle of collegiality. She said, I will empower 8 vice presidents to steer and coordinate thematic commissioners groups on each of the Commission's priorities. Of the 8 vice presidents, the 3 executive vice presidents will have a dual function. As vice presidents, they will lead a commissioners group and be supported by the Secretariat General. In addition, they will also manage a policy area and have a Directorate General under their authority as part of their job. The High Representative Vice President will support me, that's Ursula, in coordinating the external dimensions of all commissioners' work. And she said, we're going to have an all-of-government approach. Well, this is spectacular language, because this is the first time I've heard this particular phrase with respect to the European Union and the European Commission, because, of course, the all-of-government approach is the fusion doctrine. This is direct from Theresa May and Mark Sedwell. So, fascinating. Anyway, she goes on to say, your mission, Mr. Borrell, if you choose to accept it, you will be the High Representative for Foreign Policy and Security Policy and Vice President of the European Commission. She went on to say this, we need to take further bold steps in the... I've made a slight mistake there with the graphics, but don't worry. She said the European Union needs to be more strategic, more assertive, and more united in its approach to external relations. You should seek to strengthen the Union's capacity to act autonomously and provide its values and interests around the world. To be a global leader, the Union needs to take decisions in a faster, more effective, more efficient way. We must overcome unanimity constraints and hamper our foreign policy. When putting forward proposals, you need to seek to use the clauses in the treaties that allow certain decisions in the common foreign security policy to be adopted by qualified majority voting. So, David, she is talking there about strengthening the Union's capacity to act autonomously and promote its values and interests around the world. So what we're seeing is a much greater hardening of EU-level foreign policy and the EU acting as effectively as a state in its own right, so that member states won't have a foreign policy. It will be run under EU-level foreign policy. And what she's saying there quite clearly is that in order to overcome unanimity constraints, she wants to move towards a qualified majority vote, particularly for the areas of foreign policy, security and defence. So that is the removal of the veto.
Yeah, absolutely correct, isn't it? You know, this is all things considered exactly as we've forecast on, let's say, our side. You guys there at the column and everyone, this is exactly as Lord James has just forecast in the House of Lords last week. So let's decode this cloaked language, because it all sounds lovely, doesn't it? We want to strengthen, she says. What that means is we want you to weaken your position while we strengthen ours. And we're going to do that by taking away your national veto. So we want to take, be under no illusion, we want to take absolute command and control of all of the defence and security services in the EU zone, currently includes Britain and all of the British defence inventory. So, and the security inventory as well. So let's be under no illusion about that. She also wants single point source industry. So she wants all of the industry unified as well. And at that point, then they will have absolute command and control of all of the money and the capital procurement budgets and policy. Now, the key word there for everyone is genuine. Genuine, I'm going to submit, means that they, in order for the EU to be a credible or viable player in defence, would have to be, logically, a nuclear power. Now, the only way that the EU is going to be a nuclear power is to unify the French and British, or, well, ideally both, but let's say they at least unify the, you know, they take the French. But none, as it stands at the moment, it's French and British. So nonetheless, to unify the French and British nuclear deterrent into the European Defence Union system. Because the reason is they are not going to be a credible or genuine force in the time frame that von der Leyen has declared herself in the pitches that she's made and been reported as saying, any other way. So this comes immediately to the alerts that are being raised, not just by us, and all credit to General Jonathan Riley, who's just said this at their briefing meeting last week in Roosie, that in effect, that the EU want our nukes. And this is exactly dovetailing with the warnings that Lord James made in the House of Lords. And within a couple of days, we've had all these announcements coming out of the EU that they're going to build their MOD and it's going to be done with commissioners. These are non-elected commissioners who are going to take command and control of all of the defence and security services in the EU zone rapido.
Okay, well, let's move on to the next little bit because, well, this was the other commissioner that we wanted to focus on. And if we remember what Ursula had said in her letters, that as vice presidents, they will lead a commissioners group and be supported by the Secretariat General. In addition, they'll also manage a policy area and have a Directorate General under their authority. Well, the Directorate General that this lady, Sylvie Guillard, has under her authority is the Directorate General for Defence, Industry and Space. And it starts to get, just to add a little bit to what you were just saying there, David, it starts to get very interesting here, because what she said there is you will be responsible for the implementation and oversight of the European Defence Fund. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, I'm sure you will in a second, but in many of the letters and many of the form letters that UK column viewers and listeners have received from the British government over the last couple of years on this issue, they're almost at the point of denial that they're of the European Defence Fund and what the implications of it are. But anyway, she goes on to say, in doing so, I want you to encourage collaborative projects with as much cross-border participation by small and medium-sized enterprises as possible. She goes on to say, I want you to focus on building an open and competitive European defence equipment market and enforcing EU procurement rules on defence. And she said, I want you to lead on the implementation of the action plan on military mobility in close cooperation with the Commissioner for Transport. So what we're saying here, David, absolutely are the pillars of defence union being finally established in front of our eyes. The European Defence Fund given office space, given a Director General, and also military mobility, which is a very large part of the defence union concept. I don't know how I really don't know how it could be any clearer at this point.
It's crystal clear for everyone, isn't it? So, you know, just, you know, I am reliably told that Her Majesty's government are one of the major contributors into the EU Investment Bank, which flows the money into the European Defence Fund. So let's be under no illusion that on the one hand, our government has cut our national force and our national industry thereby, whilst it's been putting money into the pan-European EU Defence Union set up. So it's almost as if they've been playing okey-cokey with this, you know, in, out, shake it all about. And hopefully nobody, you know, and obviously the gambit is that nobody sees it, latches on and realises what's going on. So it's, you know, the entire British public are being completely mugged off over this thing called Brexit because it doesn't include any of this currently, whilst it's woven like some kind of hyper-complex bureaucratic spiel in terms of its policy DNA through the deal that May was finalising in the withdrawal agreement and the future declaration. So if we have any of that, we're in this lock, stock and all Her Majesty's barrels. It's as simple as that. So this is the resistance that...
Sorry, let me just ask you about that, David, because Ben Wallace was giving a presentation to a military forum yesterday or the day before, and he was making the point once again that Britain is spending the most on defence of any European nation, 2% of GDP. So my question to you is this, is EU defence union possible without Britain?
They'll carry on regardless. They're obviously arguing the toss currently.
From a practical standpoint, in terms of the military and personnel and equipment that we have, can they actually achieve their goals without including that?
They want Britain in. And it's a question of whether Britain wants to be in terms of these ministers and the people that end in government. I mean, the paperwork in the Cabinet Office suggests that that's what they want. Where Ben Wallace is concerned, you know, he's talking about this money and whatnot. You know, it's just, I mean, he's just reading from some pathetically ridiculous script that he's been given, because the money flows have just not worked like that over the last decades in terms of the investment in the national force, because they've turned off. We're not investing in the national force because we're going to have a pan-EU system. But I've got to say, where Ben Wallace is concerned, this is highly relevant. Apparently, he's been reported saying that the old officers are out of touch, and I suspect this is a bit of an attack on General Riley and Roger Lane Nott and whoever else wants to chirp up. So can I suggest to everyone, please, that they support a pushback on that front to Ben Wallace in any way they can, whether that be on Twitter or Facebook or letters or email or phone calls, that those officers are not out of touch. What they are is saying no to defence union, and that's not the same thing.
Mm. Yeah, there's been a figure of 40% of European defence capability still residing in the UK. Now, that's a figure that's been bandied around and I've heard. What's your opinion on that? If it's correct, we can understand why the European Union project is desperate to keep UK in, because without it, they exist in a greatly weakened EU super state. And of course, if they don't have control of the UK nuclear deterrent, then we sit on the sidelines as a nuclear power, which further weakens their world stage profile.
That's exactly the case. Brian, I couldn't have put that any better myself. That's exactly what the score is. And of course, they can't realistically have us not in and we're on the other flank, in effect. And I think that the nuclear issue here is really the key to all of this, because the other stuff is really, I mean, let's be honest. I mean, look at the way that they treat the personnel within the military. That, you know, they're not treated terribly, or we can ask, you know, are they really bothered? What they are bothered about is the big blue chip stuff like Trident and the attack submarines and those two aircraft carriers. They're the ticket items currently in this problem. And of course, they're desperate to get hold of them. They can't have us running around loose on the periphery acting as a nation. I mean, who knows? We might go, no, you're not doing that, which, of course, they can't have that, can they? So I think that really dovetails in perfectly with what General Riley was talking about in terms of Britain. If we, you know, if this carries on, we will be subordinate to the EU in defence, and we will be reliant upon the EU for any threats from nations that are nuclear powers. So you can see that there will be no foreign policy. The FCO might as well just pack up. It's redundant. Everyone can get the sack because we won't need it. These are dire straits for everyone. And I suggest if everybody hasn't looked at the General Riley paper, Google it, you'll find it. It's out there on all the Brexit network.
And just one final point on this, David. I just want to mention again one of the things that she said to Mr. Burrell. You will also have an important role in ensuring we better link the internal and external aspects of our policies. Again, reiterating this notion, they've been talking about it for years. We've been reporting on it for quite some time. The merging of military and civilian under a single point command and control is part of this defence union, and we can't think of it as only external action. I mean, this guy's supposed to be effectively the European foreign minister, but she's talking about internal and external policies.
That's entirely correct. It clearly as much an internal system and setup and tool as what it is potentially an external one. You cannot view it any other way. It's as much an internal arrangement against command and control of the people thereof. That cannot be underestimated. And I can add to that anecdotally that Lord Tebbit told me on no uncertain terms, of course, you know they will use this internally.
Yes. Okay, well, let's move on. Just a quick reminder, if you like what the UK Column is doing and you'd like to support us, then please head over to ukcolumn.org/community and there are various options to do that there. Brief reminder that Ian Crane is continuing his UK tour on 5G, asking is it safe? He's obviously done Bristol, Plymouth, Bournemouth and Portsmouth now. He's at Brighton tonight, Canterbury, London, Reading, and ending up on the 11th of October in Cardiff. Details on the screen at the moment. Do get along to that if you possibly can. Okay, now, let's bring David Scott onto the programme. Welcome to the programme, David. Have you any brief thoughts just before we get onto your main segment?
Well, that was a tremendous analysis. There was so much in that. That was incredible. You started off with Blair and Mandelson, Moloch and Satan running the show. The characters in play here, Malik Brown is Mr. Soros's man. 2007, Soros Quantum Fund appointed Malik Brown as his vice president. He was also appointed to Soros fund manager and Open Society Institute. He's rented a flat from him. This is the internationalist one world government big state player par excellence we're talking about here. You talked about the all of government approach. Now this is trialled in Scotland, the Scottish model of government, or SMOG, where there are no functional boundaries. That means there's nowhere to turn to. If you have a problem with the state, it's all arrayed against you. And incidentally, so is every state contractor and state funded charity. It's quite a sight to behold. The 40% number, that came from a report that came out of the EU looking at where the defence construction industry capability was, and 30-odd% was in Britain, and that didn't include our share of shared projects. So it is about 40% of the military industrial complex within Europe. And why this is particularly important is the timescale, because they're not just trying to build a European army, they're trying to build a European army by a certain time. And it was the 2017 State of the Union address by Jean-Claude Juncker. He said, and I want us to quote, and I want us to dedicate further efforts to defence matters. A new European Defence Fund is in the offing, as is a permanent structured cooperation in the area of defence. By 2025, we need a fully fledged European Defence Union. We need it, and NATO wants it. Now, Ursula von der Leyen, when she was German Defence Secretary, said that the structure for this was going to be topped out by the second half of 2020. We see that happening now. She's bang on schedule, if not ahead. That was a wonderful run through the scene, very fast moving, because it's all going in Europe's direction extremely quickly. And still at home, the press, the mainstream press, the Vichy media, won't tell the British public.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, look, Wednesday, of course, was the 11th of September, anniversary of the famous attacks. And you wanted to mention a video which has come out on World Trade Center 7, saying, well, according to the headline here, fire did not cause the third tower's collapse on September 11th, new study finds.
Yes, this is a major study. It's about 4 years worth of work run by the University of Alaska Fairbanks, with the Professor Halsey being the main mover behind this. It's a tremendous piece of work, and it leaves the official explanation of what happened in World Trade Center 7 a smoking ruin, because it looks at the structural performance of the building. It models the structural performance of the building during the collapse to an extremely high standard. It's a fine piece of work. I'll say a little more about this in a minute, but it was based on structural models developed from the original drawings, and then various fire events and damage events being simulated in that model. And they found not only did fire not cause the collapse, but they found the only thing they could model which would give the collapse that was observed was the complete removal of all columns over multiple stories simultaneously, which is of course controlled demolition. I can't emphasize how important this is in the field of 9/11 studies. This is the biggest move forward we've had in several years, and it's a very high quality piece of work. So here we see the professor in charge, and he says the principal conclusion of our study is that fire did not cause the collapse of World Trade Center 7 and 9/11. Contrary to the conclusions of NIST and private engineering firms that studied the collapse. These private engineering firms include Britain's own OVARP and partners, who did a study in association with the University of Edinburgh. Now, he goes on, the near simultaneous failure of every column explains the collapse. The secondary conclusion of our study is that the collapse of World Trade Center 7 was a global failure involving the near simultaneous failure of every column in the building. This conclusion is based primarily upon the finding that simultaneous failure of all core columns over 8 stories, followed 1.3 seconds later by the simultaneous failure of all exterior columns over 8 stories, produces almost exactly the behavior observed in videos of the collapse, whereas no other sequence of failures that we simulated produced the observed behavior. The near simultaneous failure of every column is the only scenario we identified that was capable of producing the observed behavior. Now, this is confirmation that of what some engineers and architects have been arguing for a very long time, but it's based on the most thorough study that I've ever seen concerning a building collapse. It's a phenomenal piece of work. It models heat transfer from the steelwork through to the concrete slab. It models the non-linear semi-rigid behavior of real joints. So they look at every connection between every piece of steelwork, and they model that in detail, and then they take the results of that model and put it into a global model. So when the whole building is then tested in this virtual form, with different forms of damage, different fire conditions taking place, then real-time collapse simulations can be generated. This is very unusual. It's a form of analysis that, as a structural engineer, I've never seen done before, because we're normally interested only in how buildings stand up, not on how they collapse. And this has been one of the problems that stymied the structural engineering industry from calling 9/11 for what it is, because we're not experienced in collapse, but only in instability. Now, this does extend knowledge into the area of how things collapse, and the finding is it was controlled demolition. And a thorough piece of work, a very important piece of work, and I hope people will seek out the report and the videos discussing it, and pass the message round, because it seems to once again have been ignored by the mainstream media.
Okay, thank you for that, David. Now, if I know you've got to run, but if you can stay for this one, that would be good. Because taking place at the moment, yesterday and today, is the OECD Global Blockchain Policy Forum 2019. Now, of course, they say blockchain and the ecosystem of distributed ledger technologies is still in an early stage of technological development, but is a fast evolving environment. As the hype around cryptocurrency starts to fade, now comes the time to explore the policy implications of the technology more broadly, and consider a holistic approach. They are looking to at a global level to facilitate viable and fit for purpose innovation and adoption of the technology. So this is the second annual forum on this, and they're going to convene senior decision makers from the public and private sectors, they say, experts, academics, and other stakeholders, to assess the development of blockchain over the past 12 months and delve into some of the specific challenges to implementation and adoption and so on. Now, cryptocurrencies are a big part of what's being discussed here, not just blockchain itself. And once again, and we mentioned that Bruno Le Maire, who's the French finance minister is pretty unhappy with one particular cryptocurrency, if you want to call it that. And he's reiterated that feeling again today, saying that the Libra project, the monetary with the Libra project, the monetary sovereignty of states is at stake. In these circumstances, we cannot authorise the development of Libra on European soil. Now, what's he talking about? Well, Libra, of course, is the so-called stable coin, a form of crypto coin that is being pushed by Facebook so hard at the moment. It's been criticised by various data protection organisations in the US, the EU and the UK, and they issued a joint statement, if you remember, to say to date, while Facebook and its Libra-focused subsidiary, Calibra, have made broad public statements about privacy, they failed to specifically address the information handling practices that will be in place to secure and protect personal information. But while Bruno Le Maire is extremely against this, and perhaps he's expressing a European view, Mark Carnegie, the outgoing Bank of England governor, is taking quite the opposite position, very excited about Libra. The most high-profile of these new currencies has been Libra, a new payments infrastructure based on international stablecoin, fully backed by reserve assets in a basket of currencies, including the US dollar, the euro and sterling. He's extremely pro it. And whereas Bruno Le Maire is concerned about the effect of Libra on sovereign decision-making and sovereign monetary policy, actually, Mark Carney suggesting that the reserve currency of the world, the dollar, is in such a state that it needs to be replaced by some kind of crypto-style stable coin infrastructure at the earliest opportunity. So I just wanted to get your thoughts briefly on that, David, before you go.
I'm extremely suspicious. If Mark Carney likes it, I'm extremely suspicious. There is no opposition from this banking syndicates to cryptocurrencies. You can walk out of the Bank of International Settlements in Zurich and go to the railway station, and there's a vending machine you can buy Bitcoin. Right? There's no opposition to this technology. Now, the world currencies are in a terrible state. There are only four, right? The pound, not most stable at the moment. The euro, the banking system's a disaster. The yen, that's the most indebted country in the world. And the dollar, the second most indebted country in the world. These are not good positions to be in. The dollar is king at the moment, but only because there really isn't anything stable to compete with it. The chance of having some vast contagious spread of a problem involving currencies and their purchasing power or their availability is very high. And someone will come in with a magic cure-all that maybe takes our information and gathers an awful lot of power centrally over who can buy and sell. These are not things which I find reassuring, because they're not coming from the ground up. They're not essentially protecting people's liberty. They are essentially collecting power to a central point, and that's dangerous.
Absolutely. Okay, thank you very much, David. Now, let's move on to this public service news. And this is Reuters Institute and the University of Oxford, a new report, old, educated and politically diverse, the audience of public service news. Now, they're looking at public service news broadcasters across the world, really. But and the picture is quite similar in various countries. But let's look at the BBC. It's interesting that they didn't, Brian, they didn't mention Channel 4. They deliberately excluded Channel 4 from this. So they're comparing the BBC to other news agencies with respect to the UK part of this. But what they say is that public service media are struggling to reach younger, less educated audiences and risk decline and ultimately irrelevant. So here's the two key points to take from this report. If you're old or you've been through formal education, a good formal education, you will get your news from the BBC. If you're young or you have limited formal education, i.e. you're stupid, then you won't get your news from the BBC. So that's basically what this is saying. Well, it's quite interesting that yesterday BBC Radio 4 put this broadcast out impartial journalism in a polarised world. It was hosted by the former head of BBC News, James Harding. Guests included Robert Peston, former BBC. I think he's with Sky. Is he Sky or ITV? Can't remember which.
ITV,
now.
I think.
Yeah. And also Julia Hartley Brewer was on there as well. She's from Talk Radio, of course. Now, Peston claimed that it was his role to assess the facts and present to people what it was that they needed to believe. I'm paraphrasing slightly. Julia Hartley Brewer made it clear that this was exactly the sort of arrogance that has gotten the BBC into the trouble that it's in the first place. And I think that was a fair point. Let's see what this report from Reuters Institute in Oxford has to say a bit more of it. Most of these news brands are widely used and highly trusted, but they're often less trusted on the political right and by people with populist attitudes. Now, of course, one of the points that Julia Hartley Brewer was making yesterday on Radio 4 was that most of these public service broadcasters, and in fact the private media in the UK at least, have managed to get rid of any diversity in the voices that they have that are working for them. And they've got left-leaning liberal voices. So is it any surprise if, as a result, this report finds that the BBC is less trusted by people on the political right, when the BBC doesn't have anybody working for them that actually is on the political right, that the BBC is less trusted by people with populist attitudes, because actually the BBC isn't providing anything which would resonate with those people, or by any analysis which would possibly engage with people with populist attitudes. So this is hardly surprising. And really, this report and the broadcast on Radio 4, fronted by James Harding yesterday, Brian, I don't know if you've got thoughts on this, but absolutely represent an arrogance on the part of the media. And of course, one thing that neither of them really is discussing is the fact that there is no real fourth estate role being played by these organisations. They're merely acting as mouthpieces for the government.
For the government. That's absolutely correct. I mean, out of many organisations I could point a finger at in UK, BBC would be top of my list because they are so unbelievably arrogant. But as we showed with their policy towards sex education in schools, they're highly biased to the liberal left. They recruit, they've got positive discrimination within the organisation. So they're simply not going to put across any views that anybody else is interested in. But the business that people who are not educated, well, or the people who are educated are going to watch the BBC. I mean, they are so unbelievably arrogant. David Ellis, perhaps you'd like to comment on this. I know we're tight for time, but I think this is an important one, because if we don't have free, unbiased media, we simply have the BBC version of Pravda, and we're in trouble.
Yeah, it's a terrific, you might say, just a controlled propaganda tool, isn't it? You know, and I've got to say, I find the majority of Tony Blair's new middle class, you know, lawyers, doctors, accountants, this sort, that are in that bracket, teachers to an extent, take this stuff as if it's verbatim. They don't think that, you know, this whole sort of aspect of stopping and thinking or questioning, they just lap this, you know, dreadful diatribe from the BBC up as if it's absolutely verbatim, and it's the, you know, and it's, you know, and it's the narrative. And of course, the big problem is then is when you go, well, actually, no, it's not like that, and you question the validity of it and the sources. You have this problem of sort of saying effectively, you know, it's like saying, you know, accusing a narcissist of being a narcissist, as David has said to me, that you end up in this a closed loop argument. You can't break out of that because they won't stop and think.
Yeah, and that,
what
of course,
they're being told is literally a political 1984 Orwellian syndrome.
Yeah, David, and that of course is why we have the news every hour, which simply gives you sound bites rather than true information and facts.
Yeah.
David Scott, closing up for time, but what are your thoughts?
Oh, David's gone.
We've lost him.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, there we are. David Ellis, thank you very much for joining us. I think that was a pretty important UK column news programme because we are still the only lead on exposing this terrible betrayal of Britain by the EU Defence Union programme. I'd just like to end on the fact that I've been informed that there's a planned demonstration at Rampton Hospital. That's a Melanie Shaw demonstration, apparently. But I've got to say that this is extremely disappointing and indeed delicate because Melanie Shaw at the moment is being extremely well looked after in Rampton Hospital. She hasn't asked for a demonstration. She hasn't called for people to be collecting money on her behalf. And indeed, a protest at Rampton could have serious adverse effects for Melanie's progress and hopefully release from the system. So if you've come across any of this material, I'm saying now, speaking as somebody in contact with Melanie, that this protest is not of her choosing and indeed will probably not be helpful. We leave you to make up your own decision as to whether you get involved with that event or not. Okay, that's it from us. We will be back at the same time on Monday. Thank you very much for joining us. Bye-bye.
Bye.